Hebrews chapter 11, and we're going to start with verse 1. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it, the people of old received their commendation. By faith, we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts. And through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death, and he was not found because God had taken him. Now before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And if you would turn over to verse 29. For by faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as on dry land. But the Egyptians, when they attempted to do so, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab, the prostitute, did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. You may be seated. So, if you're visiting with us, if you're joining with us, we have been working our way through the Bible, starting with the very beginning of Genesis, and we will work our way through Revelation. And during this past week's worth of readings, we transitioned from the book of Deuteronomy to the book of Joshua. From, hooray, there are many who are celebrating that transition. We transitioned from Moses' leadership to the leadership of Joshua. We encountered the supernatural crossing of the Jordan River. We encountered recommitment of the people of God to the covenant of God. We encountered various battles and conquering of the land. So those who are like Star Wars fans and those who are battle fans should begin to enjoy the process as we conquer the land. And by the way, those who think that Hollywood can make some incredible battle movies, I think God's got it covered pretty well. We see the allotment of the properties to the tribes of Israel, including the capstone of this guy named Caleb, who receives what was promised to him many, many years prior. And then we come to Easter Sunday. And this incredible resurrection day. And as I mentioned, we gather on Sundays, not just on Easter to celebrate the resurrection of Christ, but every Sunday. But we come to Easter Sunday and we go, how do we resolve this being faithful in traversing through this journey of the Bible and yet celebrating this thing called Easter? And so I had the joy of wrestling through it all week. And don't know that I'll do it justice for anybody, but we're going to give it a shot. I could jump down the road that the name Joshua in Hebrew means Yahweh is salvation. Boy, that would be convenient. We're in the book of Joshua, and we could just talk about how Yahweh is salvation. That Jesus Christ coming in flesh, dying on the cross, living, dying, being buried, resurrected is in fact salvation. And that would be pretty good, wouldn't it? We could just stop there and go with that. We could spend time talking about Rahab. And we could talk about the sign that she was to give when Israel came to conquer Jericho, the sign of the scarlet rope or thread or cloth, which in Hebrew is scarlet or crimson. Crimson is another appropriate translation for that color. And when we think of crimson, other than ringing phones, unfortunately, if he's getting a call and he has to step out, that's not usually a good thing. But talk about crimson and blood and dealing with things. So crimson, we could talk about that. That'd be really good, right? Except that, that'd really be a better Good Friday sermon. Because all too often we talk about the death of Jesus, around Easter, especially because of Good Friday. And we're here not because Jesus is dead, but he's alive. He's risen. Okay, I need your help this morning. Otherwise, it's going to be a really long morning, okay? So we could celebrate the blood of Jesus, which is absolutely essential. It's foundational. It's fundamental to the Christian faith. But we're here and we celebrate on Sundays because he is risen. Okay, there we go. And so talking about the crimson or the scarlet thread would be a great way to go, wouldn't it? Yeah. Or we could continue on Rahab and this really obscure recommendation that she has for the spies. Remember she hides them up in the top. The guard goes out and she lets them down and she gives them a really intriguing instruction. Go hide yourselves for 3 days. Not one day, not 2 days, not 4, 5, or 6 days. She instructs them to go hide for 3 days. And so wouldn't it be really fun to sit there and talk about the threes in scripture and talk about 3 days that they were called to hide themselves? And I've chosen not to do any of those. While all of those are important and I think would be fun. Oftentimes we look at the nation of Israel as being analogous to our own spiritual journeys. We acknowledge that they faced many battles and that at the point in time that we're reading along in the Bible here that they are conquering the land and they're getting their promised possessions. And at other times they're facing many battles as the result of their own sin and the struggles in their own life. And we bring that into the life that we have today. And do we realize that we are all in battles? How many of us acknowledge that we're in battles? Okay, most of us acknowledge that we're in battles. Some of the battles are good. We're advancing with God to take possession of territory that he wants for us to have. Some of our battles are bad because just like Israel, we succumb to some of that sinful nature and those sinful tendencies. And as a result, we're in conflict of our own doing. Well, this morning, one of the things that I want to look at or I've chosen is kind of this grander picture. And I want to call it three keys for fighting the battles. Three keys for fighting the battles. And I believe that what we will find is just coincidentally, it does tie into Easter. And the first key that I want to highlight for us as we look at the passages this morning is that we fight for victory from victory. Take a moment and process that. We fight for victory from the place of victory. This is foundational to the journey of Israel as we've been reading. But too often, one of the things that happens is we believe it's our fight to fight. And we talked a little bit last week about the consuming fire and the desire of the consuming fire to fight that fight. But so often we look at the battles that surround us, whether it be in our own personal life, our interior life with our soul, or whether it be the external influences of the world. And we're in these battles and we think that somehow we have to stand strong and we have to fight the battle. And it's dependent upon our strength and our abilities and our skills and all that kind of stuff. But what we find through the nation of Israel is a constant promise of God that he fights the fight. We begin back in Genesis chapter 15 where he promises Abraham that they will inherit the land of Canaan. It's a promise. It's a covenant relationship. So God is going to fulfill what he's promised. And part of the reason we know that the time frame takes place, that there's this 400 years is because what does God tell Abraham? Because they need to be in captivity and they're going to be in captivity. But why are they going to be in this captivity? Well, because they sinned against God, but even greater than that, the Amorites The Amorites had not yet come to the fullness of their sin for God to engage them. And so we see this journey, but we see the promise revealed over and over and over. Turn with me to Exodus chapter 23. Exodus chapter 23, we're going to begin near the end of the chapter, verse 27. Exodus 23, verse 27. This is God speaking now, I will send my terror before you and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come. And I will make all of your enemies turn their backs to you, and I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in one year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply against you. Now, just stop there for a second. How often do we want God to do it right now? And how much? I mean, who wouldn't want, for the sake of Israel, for it to have been done right now? That as soon as they crossed over the Jordan, God just eliminated everyone for their sin. And yet God right here promises, I'm going to give it to you, but I'm not going to give it to you in just one really quick handful. Because things will become chaotic and things will be overrun. How often in our own lives do we want it taken care of right now? It reminds me of the passage where Jesus talks about how a man cleans out the house. But he never fills it with anything else. And so the spirits that went out, what? Grabbed their friends and brought more spirits back to only create more battles and more oppression in the person's life. How much more do we see this in the life of Israel? I'm not going to wipe them out in a single count, not even in a year, because other things will happen that you don't understand. Verse 29, I will not drive them out from you in one year, lest the land become desolate and wild beasts multiply against you. Little by little, I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and possessed the land. And I will set your borders. And then verse 32, you shall make no covenant with them and their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Now, flip over to Joshua chapters. Well, just start with Joshua chapter 2. We're going to pick up at verse 8. This is the story of Rahab that's going on. Before the men laid down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the fear of you has fallen upon us. Now just stop there a second. She says, I know that the Lord has what? Is that future tense? Present tense, actually. Past. The Lord has given you. So when the Israelites are going to fight, are they going to fight for the future? Where are they fighting from? It's already there. We fight for victory from victory. I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the fear of you has fallen upon us. And that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. Turn to chapter 6, verse 1. Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out and none came in. Wow. God promises it in Exodus. We get to see the fulfillment of it in the words of Rahab in Joshua 2 and then the reality in Joshua 6. Now, if you back up just a few verses, Joshua chapter 5, verse 13, when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went out and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, no. Don't you love that? He doesn't actually answer the question. He just says, no. He says, you don't get it. I'm not for them and I'm not for you. He says, I am the commander of the army of the Lord. And then you talk about a pretty profound statement. Now I have come. I'm here. Let it all start taking place. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." Hopefully some bells are going off here. These are words that have been spoken before, yes? When? The burning bush. Moses is interacting with God, and the first thing God says is, "Take off your sandals, for where you're at is holy ground." And Joshua hesitated for a while because of the scorpions on the ground. No, Joshua did so. Now, I suspect that's not the totality of the conversation that was had. I don't think that's the end of it. It's the end of what we have written, but I don't think that was the end of it. Now, work with me here. What do you think was entailed in the remainder of the conversation? What he was expected to do, because we know that he's got the command then, right, with Jericho. Okay, so there's the instruction, there's the battle plan that's being drawn up. What else? The promise. I think the promise was huge. I think the angel of the Lord, the commander of the Lord's army, probably sat Joshua down and said, "Let me just remind you of the story here." And starting with maybe even Genesis 1, God created. Genesis 15, and then he promised, and coming through to now. Now look, you've crossed the Jordan, and you've got this mighty, mighty, mighty foe in front of you. In fact, it scared 10 of the 12 of you 40 years ago. It kept you from entering this land for 40 years. But if God's promised it, then it's going to happen. And so Israel needed to learn the lesson that we fight for victory from victory. And this remains true for us today. We fight for victory in the Christian journey from the place of victory. And so often we feel like we are starting on losing ground. One of the most significant truths of Christianity, which sets us apart from all other religions of the world, is that we worship a living God. He's risen. The one thing that separates us from the rest of the world's religions. If you go to Buddhism, guess who they pray to? Is Buddha dead or alive? Dead. How about Muhammad? Dead. We could keep going through listing all of them, right? We know from the Old Testament, the Baals and the Ashtoreths and all these other gods, they're all dead. So the one thing of all else that sets us apart from the rest of the religions of the world is that he's risen. And so we serve a risen Savior, not somebody that is buried in a grave. Turn to Ephesians chapter 1 with me. Heard me say this, I will continue to say this. This is one of the greatest prayers in Scripture. Has become just ingrained in myself. We're not going to read the whole prayer, but Paul is praying for the church in Ephesus, and in verse 19, we'll pick it up. Ephesians 1, verse 19, and I pray, "And what is the immeasurable greatness of his power toward us who believe, according to the working of his great might?" Now, Paul could have stopped right there. He could have just said, "You know about the creative power of God." He could have said, "You know about the numbers of stars that are in the sky." He could have rewritten back to Romans chapter 1 and said that all of creation declares my glory. And I've made myself known. And if you don't know me, it's your own fault because I've already made myself known. And all that kind of stuff. He could have talked about the history of Israel. He could have talked about coming out of the Exodus and crossing the Red Sea, crossing the Jordan River, the defeat of Jericho, the defeat of the nations. He could have talked about anything, but the way that Paul continues his prayers, "I pray that you would know the power of God that he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead." Now, here's the key. Paul's prayer is that we would know the power of God that raised Jesus Christ from the dead. Not the power that enabled Jesus to do miracles. I mean, how many of us want that power? We're kind of like, I'd love to just walk up to somebody and, you know, touch them on the shoulder and they're healed, or, you know, cast out demons. That would be incredible power. But the reference point that Paul goes to is the power to raise Jesus Christ from the dead, the ultimate power. And Paul says, my prayer is that you would know it not just here, but in your life, you would have personal experience with that power of God. See, death has been conquered by Jesus Christ, so we don't need to fear death. He's overcome sin, so we don't need to fear sin. He's overcome Satan, so we don't need to fear Satan. We fight in the Christian journey for victory from victory because he's risen. Yeah, you guys are kind of waning now. We just have to get this in our minds that the great movie, right? God's not dead. Sometimes we're still thinking that God's out there in outer space somewhere and the whole clock worker stuck us in motion and then just abandoned us. And we have the story. We know the story. Jesus comes in human form. God comes in human form and he walks this earth and he defeats all that there is. He dies. He's raised to life. And yet how often do we fight from victory from a place of death? From a place of wounding, a place of weakness. And what we find in the journey of Israel and carried through in the scriptures, and we celebrate this Easter morning, is that we fight not from death and not from weakness and not from hurt, but we fight from victory. Because the victory has already been had, and we recognize that there are battles that we might lose, but we know the ultimate outcome of the war. But I think we lose too many battles because we fight from defeat already rather than fighting from victory. And so we're called to fight from victory. So we fight for victory from a position of victory. Let me go ahead and have the kids come up. You guys are like perfectly positioned. And Jim and Sarah are going to be kids today too. I know there's more coming, so we'll. They're fighting to sit by me. That was kind of you, Liza, to let Hunter sit by me. All right. I don't know if we're all here now. Because you like me. Aw, I like you too. I brought with me today.
So did I.
Yeah, oh, so did you. Well, you know what? You could just go sit back down in your seat then, because it's not going to do any good. Who likes gum? Most of you? All of you? You're chewing a piece right now. Well, then I'm not going to give you a piece of gum. You have bubble gum eggs. Did you get some bubble gum eggs today?
No.
Oh, you don't have them with you right now? Well, Hunter, you're sitting right next to me. Why don't you grab a piece of gum? Just one piece.
Carrie, I might have this cup with my mom.
It's what? Empty. Are you sure? Open it up. It's empty. Let's try a different piece. Because, I mean, I would expect gum to be in here if it's packages of gum. It's empty. Let's try another one. It's really cool. There's 5 pieces of double mint gum in here. Was that empty? It's not April Fool's. It's not April 1st. Are you going to try those too? Okay, is it there? Oh, does it smell like it had gum in it?
It smells like it's gross.
It smells like it's gross. Well, it smells like spearmint gum to me. So is there any gum in that at all? Now, let me ask you a question. almost 2,000 years ago. Here, I'll give you that. That's a present from me to you. Don't throw it away. It's a gift. It's a gift. You don't want to throw away my gift, do you? Here, come here. Here, Hunter, sit down here. We're not done yet. Now, I want you to, the store's a ripoff. You know what? Maybe I should take that back to the store. Thank you. I'm gonna set that right there, and maybe I should take that back to the store. Now, almost 2,000 years ago.
I think you ate all the gum.
You think I ate all the gum? You saw me open the packet. Thank you. You saw me open the package. Did you expect gum to be in there? Yes? You think I took it? You were right. You think I taped it? Nope, there's no tape on it. I will let you look all over this for tape. There is no... Okay, you look all over it for tape. Now, when you're handed a package of gum, what do you expect to be in there?
Gum.
So almost 2,000 years ago, when the disciples went to the tomb that Jesus was buried in, what did they expect to find there? His body. What did they find there? Nothing. Why? Because somebody stole the body? No. Because Jesus rose from the dead. Excellent. So is Jesus dead or alive? Well, some of you believe he's alive. Jesus is dead, but the grave is empty. Did somebody steal his body? No. So is he dead or alive?
Alive.
So do you think it was pretty surprising to them when they showed up that morning? It was empty? So because Jesus was alive, what did Jesus defeat?
Death.
He defeated death. You guys are just too smart. Maybe you should preach. Do you want to finish the sermon?
No.
I'll bet you you could.
I can't read.
You can't read? That's all right. I don't think you need to read. You could just preach whatever God's got on your heart.
Here.
As long as it's not egg bubblegum.
Here.
Okay. Did you find any tape?
I'm allergic to
tape. Did you find any tape?
No. But
no.
I ripped it.
I see you ripped that. How am I going to return this to the store?
You don't need to. You need to tape
it. I need to tape it. And then should I give it to my
kids?
Because
that is garbage.
It's garbage.
Your kids have to eat that garbage.
They have to eat that garbage. I don't think that would be any good. So if Jesus is alive, Caleb's chewing all the gum. If Jesus is alive and the tomb was empty and he defeated death, what else did Jesus defeat? Satan, absolutely. What else did Jesus defeat? He defeated the grave.
He did not defeat a soda pop.
I think Jesus could defeat a soda pop. Selah? Sin. He defeated sin. Because the wages of sin is death. And so Jesus defeated the wages of sin, which is death. So do you think they were surprised?
Yeah?
What I want you to think about this morning and for Easter today, whether you're doing Easter egg hunts, whether you're eating a whole bunch of Easter candy.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want you to be thinking about, am I as surprised as those disciples were? Or am I so convinced that Jesus is alive that I don't need to be surprised? Can I be so convinced that I know that when I have a battle that Jesus wants me to fight, that he's already fought the battle and the victory is already ours to have? How many of us like victory? How many of us like victory? You hate victory? Oh boy, we got to work on that. We all like victory, right? So let's be reminded. Let's be reminded that since we have victory in Jesus, hey, that'd be a great song sometime, right? Victory in Jesus. Since we have victory in Jesus, we also have victory in this life, okay? All right. Because we talked so much about peeps last week, guess what treat I have for you in the back? You've got peeps back there. So go see Miss Jennifer. I heard some of you roasted peeps. I am even proud to say that somebody sacrificed the peep last week. Now, I don't know, hey, Mr. Larry, are you back there somewhere? Somebody lost a coat. I could auction it off. Roasted peep. Well, Mr. Larry had talked about having a fire going outside to roast them, but no, I'm assuming that didn't happen. It's too rainy. Yeah. We'll use that as the excuse. Yeah. We talked about maybe an altar up here on the altar, and we fight for victory from victory, not a place of defeat. The second thing that I think we need to see in the journey that we have been on is that victory comes by faith. So we fight for victory from victory, but that victory comes by faith. Israel overcomes the enemies by faith in the instructions of God. I mean, how many of us would have the brilliant plan to walk around the city sounding trumpets and that's all? How many like military schools is that written into the battle plans? You know, hey, if all else fails, just walk around the city. I think it's just in the one that matters, right? So it's by faith. And we come to this incredible story of this woman named Rahab. A woman. Strike one. In the context of the story, she's a Gentile. Strike two. She has one of the oldest professions in the world. Strike three. Some of you are laughing. It really is one of the oldest professions in the world. She's an Amorite. Strike four. Why is it important to note that she's an Amorite? You guys speak like my teenage son right now. Because what? That's who God is going to defeat. The sin of the Amorites had not yet come to fruition. And she's an Amorite. Now look at chapter 2 with me. Because one of the things that is profound is how much Rahab's life reflects each and every one of our lives. In more ways than we would like to acknowledge, including her old-time profession. Chapter 2, verse 13. Well, let's start at 12. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house and give me a sure sign, and that you will save alive my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from... What is one thing that Rahab knew? She had a death sentence. Not a death wish. She had a death sentence. She knew that. Why did she know it? Because she knew what had happened when Israel began to walk through the countries. She knew that they were all killed. We find out over and over, right? They took the sword. They took the edge of the sword to the city, to the nation, to the country. So she has a death sentence. For the wages of sin is... Do we have a death sentence? You're just running ahead of me. We've all had a death sentence. Some of us may still have a death sentence. Look at verse 10. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. How long ago did the Red Sea take place? 40 years. Now, we can't arguably say that they heard about it immediately after the Red Sea, but it's pretty likely that they probably heard about it pretty much right after the Red Sea, because there haven't been too many Red Sea stories that have occurred in the history at that point in time. So if they heard about it shortly afterwards, how long have they had? 40 years. give or take, right? They've had a 40-year grace period to change their ways. They've heard the stories. They know this God that is coming through with this nation of Israel, and they have had a grace period. We've all been given a grace period. If we are still breathing right now, we have been given a grace period. If you're not, that's another story. And Dr. Morris has a lot more to deal with today than if we're breathing, we have been given a grace period. Look at verse 8. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and she said to the men, she said what? She said, I what? I know. She said, I know. I mean, in those circumstances, our response would often be, I heard. She didn't just hear, she believed. She said, I know that the Lord has given you the land. I know that you are fighting for victory from victory. There's belief in her mind. I know, not that I've heard. And then we jump to verse 11. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted. And there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, here's her profession of faith, is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Now, wait a second. They've got this multitude of gods that they worship in Jericho. They've got a whole bunch of gods that they believe in. And so her profession of faith is to sit there and go, I've heard what's going on, and they don't compare. You know what? As a matter of fact, I don't think my gods that I've been worshiping even listen to me. And so here is truly the God of heaven and the God of earth. And so then what we find as we jump down to verse 18, behold, when we come into the land, this is the spies speaking to Rahab, you shall tie this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. You shall gather into your house your father and mother and your brothers and all of your sisters. And then we jump to chapter 6, verse 22, and it's the story of after the walls have come down, they rescue, they redeem Rahab. By faith, victory is found. I mean, it's kind of a crazy story, right? Scandalous woman turns God spy. Scandalous woman turned God spy. You know, she's mentioned three times in the New Testament. In Hebrews chapter 11, in James chapter 2, and in both cases, she's called Rahab the harlot, the prostitute. But it's really interesting. The third place is Matthew chapter 1, verse 5, where she's in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. And here's what's crazy about this. Scandalous woman turns spy, finds victory, and gets a new name. She is no longer Rahab the harlot, Rahab the prostitute. She is now Rahab. I know somebody's looking it up. She is now Rahab, the wife of Salome. She is now Rahab, the wife of Salome. Now, I mean, we could do a whole sermon on the juxtaposition there, right? Rahab the harlot to Rahab the wife and everything that goes on in between that. But it's significant not just because of the name change. Salome marries Rahab. In 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verses 10 and 11, we actually find that Salome's father is referred to as one of the princes of Israel, which makes Salome likely a prince of Israel. In fact, what I understand is that Jewish history refers to Salome as one of the princes of Israel. Further, what we find interesting is that Jewish history seems to believe that Salome became acquainted with Rahab as one of the spies sent into Jericho. So, Salome, as a prince of Israel, winds himself up in a prostitute's home finds himself somehow attracted to her. Maybe it wasn't even physical. Maybe it was the fact that he saw faith in her that she had, maybe even more so than he had in the same God. They wed, and they have a son named Boaz, who, when he is born, is ruthless. Okay. Some of you are still processing that right now. Boaz is the kinsman redeemer for Ruth. The second woman who is in the lineage of Jesus. Ruth, with Boaz, has a son named Obed, who has a son named Jesse, who has a son named David, who becomes king. We're not talking hundreds of generations here. We're talking a few generations here. And so this harlot named Rahab becomes known worldwide for all of history as being in lineage of Jesus Christ. Victory is found by faith. As a side note, it's really interesting, this whole battle of Jericho scenario where they're walking around sounding the trumpets. Last time they're roaring and hooting and hollering, and you know, everybody in Jericho's looking down on them, thinking that they're morons and all that kind of stuff, right? Rahab's house is on the wall. Whether it's physically in the wall or on the wall is debated, but we've got to recall that these are not walls like, you know, just our picket fences. They actually ran chariot races on these walls. So they're like 15, 20 feet wide, and Jericho was double walled. So they had a 15 to 20 foot wide wall, and there was probably about a 15 foot gap with another 15 to 20 foot wall, and the wall ranged in height somewhere between 15 and 20 feet. Now, think about this. When they walked around and the walls came down, there was a lot of rubble. In fact, if they had come down sideways, how much of a wall was still there? 15 to 20 feet because of the thickness of the wall having come down on its side. So what good would it have done then? Archaeological digs have seemed to indicate that when the walls fell, they fell into the earth. They fell vertically. How else would you be able to immediately attack? Is that incredible? By faith? I mean, sure, maybe we can make enough noise, we can get enough jackhammers, we can do all this kind of stuff to bring down the rubble. But then all of a sudden we have like 12 to 15 feet of rubble to climb over to try to attack. By faith, they defeat Jericho because God removes the walls. And what does it look like to be walking around? And by the way, they had enough people that it probably surrounded the whole city, right? So all these walls come down except for one tower that has a scarlet cord. So the spies go, that's Rahab's house. Now, another thing of importance is when Rahab is in essence redeemed by faith in the promise of the spies, in the God of Israel, she doesn't keep it to herself. When Rahab finds victory through faith, what is she doing? She's called to go share it and rescue others. Victory comes by faith. Now contrast that with a story that we find only a couple of chapters later. A guy by the name of Achan. Achan goes up to the city of Ai, they lose. And what we find out, I think, you know, Achan heard the same word of the Lord that Rahab heard. Did he not? Actually, Achan heard firsthand the word of the Lord that Rahab did. Rahab believed Faith brought victory. For Achan, he failed to believe, and that lack of faith brought death. He failed to believe because when he was part of this battle in Jericho, he saw a few things that caught his eye. And where God had told them to destroy everything, Achan said, I don't believe God. I don't have faith in God, and so I'm going to grab a few things to care for myself. And it ends up costing him his life. Zechariah chapter 4, verse 6 reminds us that it is not by might, it is not by power, it is by the Spirit, declares the Lord of hosts. We need to be reminded that it's not our own abilities, it's not our own skills, it's not our own strength, it's not our own stick-to-itiveness, it's not our own manliness that can pick it up when we fall down. It's not any of that stuff. It is by the Spirit of God. And so victory is found in faith. 1 John chapter 5, verse 4 says that faith is the victory that overcomes the world. Hebrews 11, 6, we read it this morning. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Well, we're not really talking about pleasing God, but if you continue on in the verse, it says, whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists. So by faith, we have victory. By faith, we believe that God exists. God's not dead. He is risen. Okay. Kind of getting it. Now you're sitting there going, is he going to say it? When's he going to say it? Our faith is found in a risen Savior that we celebrate, not one that is made of stone or wood or still sealed at a grave somewhere. And so our faith is not in vain, as Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 15. Our faith is not in vain. If Jesus did not raise from the dead, then our faith is in vain. But our faith is not in vain because Jesus has risen. And so just as Israel needed to understand that their victory did not come because of their military prowess, their victory came because of their faithfulness in God. So also we need to be reminded that our faith, our victory does not come because we're now smarter. We're 2,000 years advanced. We have so much technology. We have so much so-called wisdom and knowledge and understanding. Our same victory comes about the same way as Israel's, and that is by faith. By faith in the resurrected God. So, we fight for victory. From victory, we get victory by faith. And finally, we need to understand that victory requires engagement. Unfortunately, there are far too many of us that think that we have this come to Jesus experience and then we can sit down and just let God do the rest. But somehow we get this mental process going that since God's done it, since we get victory from victory, and since it's just faith that brings us victory, then somehow we can just sit down and have no responsibility. But Israel is called to engage the enemy. Sometimes it's without conflict at all, right? I mean, it starts out, Israel, just walk around the city. Sometimes God says, just sit down and be quiet. We don't like that because we're thinking battle. Let's go. Let's pull the sword out. Let's start fighting. I've been pumping iron. I'm ready to go. Let's get this fight on, right? Let's have it. And then God says, just walk around the city. Sitting here thinking, I don't need any more cardio, God. And how many of us in our Christian life today, we sit there and go, okay, God, I'm ready to fight. I'm prayed up. I'm studied up. I'm good to go. And God says, just sit and be quiet and listen. Now, after that walking around, after the sitting in quiet, there's usually an engagement that takes place because after the walls came down, what'd they have to do? Fight. Go in and destroy. Rahab had to place the scarlet crimson cord in the window. What, could you imagine the seventh time they're going around, the trumpets are starting to sound, and she goes, where's the scarlet cord? Who's, get that off your waist, I need that! You know, what's going on? I think Rahab was diligent, I think she tied it on there the minute they left, because she goes, I am not gonna forget about this. My life is not gonna be in my hands because I messed up. I'm engaged. And we know that she was engaged because when she's rescued, family members are also rescued. She took on the responsibility, she tied the cord, but she also went out and she shared the story. She was engaged. This guy named Caleb, he's 85 years old. In Joshua chapter 14, he's running around engaged in the battle to the very end. 85 years old. I know men and women a whole lot younger than that that have either directly or indirectly articulated, I'm done. I've served my time. I've done my time. I don't have anything left to do. Caleb is 85 and he's still going after giants. And it's crazy because we find out in Joshua chapter 14 that he goes in as a spy when he's 40. Oftentimes we think of these guys as some young bucks, right? These 15, 20-year-olds that are just spry and they can conquer the world and they just, you know. Caleb's 40 years old. He's me minus a year. He's 40 years old when he goes in. Then he gets to wander the wilderness till he's 80. Maybe that's what it is. I'm not trying to pick on, but maybe we just get stuck in wandering in the wilderness for too long. And maybe that's just what it is. If we're sitting, I don't care if we're 21 or if we're 90, if we're sitting here not engaged in the battle, then maybe we're stuck in the wilderness. And need to be reminded that it's time to be engaged. He's 40 years old. Wanders around for 40 years. We get a great time picture here because 40 years in the wilderness, he's now 80. They cross the Jordan. Joshua 14 says that he is 85. This is to help us understand. God said, I promise you that I'm going to give you the land, but I'm not going to give it to you in a year. Why? Because wild beasts and all this other stuff might just start to overrun the whole territory if they entered when Caleb's 80 and he now gets his allotment at 85. How long did it take for them to conquer? There's at least 5 years of ongoing battle. And I'll bet you Caleb is out in the front of it with Joshua. I'll bet you Caleb's standing there going, Joshua, what's the next move? Give it to me. Tell me what it is. And as soon as Joshua looks and goes, I think, and Caleb's just like gone. Caleb knew the promise. He knew that in order to have victory, he had to be engaged in the fight. And God had given him a promise. Now here's the crazy thing. God had given him a promise. What was the promise to Caleb? That he would get certain land. Back up to Genesis chapter 15 for a second. What was the promise to Abraham? That his descendants would get the promised land. What's the promise to Caleb? That Caleb would get a certain portion. How do these two covenants contrast? In Genesis chapter 15, the promise is that Abraham's descendants would get the land. To Caleb, the promise is that Caleb would get the land. So when they started fighting, when he's 80 years old, what did Caleb know? He knew that he would get land. He knew that whatever age he got his land, that he was fighting from victory. Because he'd already been given the promise and God had been true to the promise. So he knew no matter what giants he went against, no matter what hill Joshua said take, he was going to see the promised land that he was promised. the allotment that he was given for him, not for his descendants, but for him personally. He's invincible because he goes, it's not by might nor by sword, but by the Spirit declares the God of hosts. Do we fight invincibly? Do we know the promises of God? Do we even believe that we fight for victory from victory? Do we fight hard enough in the spiritual battles of our lives and the physical battles of our lives? Because we say, I don't care what happens to me. There is no promise that he wouldn't be maimed, that he wouldn't lose an arm or a leg. Now, he didn't, but there was no promise of that. The promise was that he would get to have his allotment. And so for 5 years, I wonder if Caleb at any point in time said, are we done yet? God, you promised me this land. Are we done yet? Or did Caleb keep sitting there going, I know I'm getting it. I know I'm getting it. I don't know when I'm going to get it. I might outlive Moses. I don't know when I'm going to get it. But I'm going to get it because God promised that I'm going to get it. So I'm going to keep going until I get it. Victory is found in engagement. It requires that we be engaged. Jesus didn't come, live his life, die, and come back to life for us to sit back and do nothing. We are called to be engaged. There is a lost and a dying world that is outside the walls of this church, but that reaches inside the walls of this church. And we must engage for the kingdom. Satan is at work attacking us in our own lives. And we must engage for our own well-being. Jesus says, I have come that you might have life, abundant life. But it means we need to be engaged in the battle to live it abundantly. Too often I think we get weary from the battle. For some reason I look at Caleb and I think he found vibrancy in the battle because he knew the promise. I think Caleb experienced abundant living because he was engaged in the battle for the promise that he had been given. Ephesians chapter 6 calls us to put on the battle armor. It calls us to stand. It calls us to pray. And until the call changes, that's what we must do. Some of us are swinging our swords, and we're not to be swinging them yet. Some of us have sat down, and we need to be standing. Some of us are sleeping. We forgot where the sword even was, and the trumpet has been sounded, and we're supposed to be rushing. What's the promise that God has just affirmed in you? I mean, we're already into Joshua. You can't tell me that there hasn't been one promise of God spoken into your life from the Word of God. What is one of those promises that you need to become like Caleb that says, God's giving me this regardless of the journey that I have to walk through to get it? Victory requires our own personal engagement in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that is huge because it is not just engagement in the battles. We are called to be engaged in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Paul cries out, oh, to know the sufferings of Jesus Christ. Paul wanted to be engaged in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Oh, that you would know the power at work in Jesus Christ. Many of us, the entire world, is fighting a battle for our soul. And the only means of victory is through the resurrected Jesus Christ that we celebrate today. We fight for victory from victory because Jesus Christ achieved the victory when that tomb was empty. When he defeated sin, he defeated death, he defeated Satan. The very thing that we're here celebrating this morning. Resurrection Sunday. We have victory because Jesus is victory because he's risen. They're falling asleep now. If we're not engaged in the resurrected life of Jesus Christ, then how will others find victory? If we are not engaged in the resurrected life of Jesus Christ, how will others find victory? Father, this morning, what an awesome privilege to like the nation of Israel, have these memorial moments and markers. And Father, you gave us this one, call it what we want, Easter, Resurrection Sunday, celebration of life. Father, call it whatever. You have given us this time to celebrate because Jesus is victor. And we celebrate the victory of Jesus Christ. But Father, too often we just celebrate it and let it go instead of celebrating it and engaging in it. Would you move us in such a fashion this week that Easter was not just another holiday. It's not just another holy day. But Father, would you awaken us and cause us to celebrate to such a degree that it carries over, that tomorrow morning when we wake up, we are engaged in the resurrected life of Jesus. That when we go to bed tonight, we are engaged in the resurrected life of Jesus. Father, there are some of us here this morning that have for so long been searching for victory. Maybe it's victory over an addiction. Maybe it's victory over sin. Maybe it's victory over life. I don't know, God, but many of us in here have been suffering and longing for victory, and it's because we've kind of surrendered the fact that we already have victory, and we need to live it out. We need to be engaged in it. Father, some of us lack the faith to believe that your promises are true. Some of us lack the recollection of your promises. Would you remind us of those? Would you increase our faith? When we lack faith, would you give us faith? Would we cry out like one man, Jesus, help my unbelief. Give me faith. Father, engage us in the battle at hand, large or small. Spiritual, physical, advancing and conquering or defensive. But Father, build our faith to engage the battle, to see, to experience, to proclaim the victory that has already been. Father, this day as we celebrate, as we eat chocolate bunnies, as we eat marshmallow eggs, as we eat whatever is before us, may we eat with joy and celebration because of the victory we have in Jesus Christ.